This is a People First Radio podcast.
CHLY 101.7 FM, Vancouver Island. On the web, www.chly.ca.
Psychotherapist Mike Pond built a life helping others struggling with addiction, but he couldn't help himself. In the first part of his memoir, Wasted, Mike recounts how he lost his practice, his home, and his family as a result of his out-of-control drinking. He also details how abstinence-based treatment regimes failed to help him. Mike Pond wrote Wasted along with his partner Maureen Palmer, and the two have since embarked on a quest for evidence-based treatments. They sought out science-backed therapies that don't always demand abstinence. Their search is chronicled in the second half of the book.
That description comes from the website of CBC's The Nature of Things. You can find Mike and Maureen's documentary film, also called Wasted, at cbc.ca. You can find their book, Wasted, online at Amazon or in bookstores across North America. I spoke with Mike Pond and Maureen Palmer earlier this week. Mike, one of the key messages that emerges from the first half of your book, and it was earlier published under the title A Couch of Willingness, is that your path to sobriety was filled with multiple so-called treatment experiences. What did you learn during all that time about the notion of treatment?
The main thing I learned is that the treatment was flawed. In fact, you know, the subtitle is broken, you know. And there's many people now since then, experts and professionals, Dr. Evan Wood and many others that basically agreed that the system is broken.
But I think the other thing that you really felt in every aspect of your downfall was shame, that no matter where you went, that was the predominant feeling.
Yeah, right from, you know, going into ER, which we did a research and a talk for one of the unions, and I've been in ER 31 times over that 4.5-year period when my drinking was really severe. And right from the ER to doctors, my own family doctor, nurses, social workers, it was a shame-based, judgmental approach. And I dreaded going in to see anybody to talk about this because I knew that was how it was going to go. And I don't blame the system. This is the way it's been for a long time. And, we can go back for probably hundreds of years and see how people that suffered with mental illness and substance use problems were treated. And we were put in asylums. We were put in prisons. And then after, prohibition, AA stepped in with their model, and that's 80 years ago. 1935, and that model has not changed, and it is, you know, the primary approach in 80 to 90% of all treatment programs.
You've mentioned shame, and Mike, you pointed out how badly people have been treated in the past. I'm wondering, Maureen, if we can ask you about stigma and the misunderstandings about addiction. What have you learned during the time that you've been in relationship with Mike?
I learned that pretty well everything I thought about addiction was wrong. I also know that I sort of felt the shame myself. When Mike and I first started dating, I kept Mike's story a secret from all of my friends and family. It was kind of funny, actually, because my mom met Mike on Christmas Eve. We went to Mass, and she said, I asked her after, what do you think of that Mike I've been dating? She goes, well, I think he's a lovely man, but I think he has a secret. Oh, grandmothers, right? And
yeah.
Mothers. So yeah, I felt that, I bought into the shame. And then the more I got to know Mike, the more I got to do, especially the research for The Nature of Things, I realized his experience was the experience of tens of hundreds of thousands, and that we who didn't have the problem, were actually making it worse with all of our judgment. And I think that that was such an eye-opener for me, right? The other big thing I learned was, like anybody else who has any condition, whether it's cancer or multiple sclerosis or heart disease, the person who's suffering with it or living with it wants to be autonomous. They want to control their own disorder, and at least at bare minimum, have a say. With addiction, we have robbed people of that capability. You know, everybody says, here's what you need to do, and here's how you should do it, and here's how we're going to monitor that you do it, to a place where, you know, we've learned that what really works for people is to be self-motivated. Our current approach takes away self-motivation.
Yeah. You know, Kevin, I was just listening to Maureen and thinking it through further. I've been doing this work. I've been a psych nurse, social worker, psychotherapist, a manager, all kinds of different positions in this field for over 40 years. And I was one of those people that would say, when people come in and see me, and if they had an alcohol use problem or a drug use problem, I would say, look, I can't work with you till you go and get sober or you get clean. So you go to AA, you go to a treatment center, and then you come back and see me, and then maybe we'll talk about it. So I was a part of that. I worked in Emerge, and I was a psychiatric liaison nurse, and I remember these people would come in and go, oh, my goodness, there he is again. You know, that's the third time he's been in here this week. He's drunk. You know, why can't he get it together? And so I would be one of the ones, you know, speaking that way and that attitude. And then when I was on the other side of the bars and the fence, literally, I could hear them. I could hear those murmurings. I could hear it. And I was going, oh, my goodness. You know, I was that, you know. And it's just so sad, you know, that the system has been this way. And I understand it's stressful work. And we're not easy to work with, but I think it's because it's evolved that way because it's so embedded in the shame, and it's coercive and it's punitive, any kind of treatment, that we've become a part of that as well. And that's why so many of us don't go into treatment. We estimate now through the research that we've done that 80-90% of the people that have this problem don't voluntarily go and seek help. That's not good, and it's there for a reason. So the system rate from the grassroots level, you know, from those low-end recovery houses I was in, where people were shamed constantly, and one young man was shamed so terribly in there that, you know, he hanged himself, and I had to cut him down and try to resuscitate him, and it was terrible. He was the same age as one of my sons at the time, and
you know, these places need to be shut down by the provincial government. There's no other illness or disorder where we would warehouse people. We actually used to do it to a certain extent with the mentally ill. We don't do it anymore. In fact, most of the people in those places, I would argue, are also mentally ill.
Yeah.
They need to be shut down because they are treating people with a serious mental disorder with nothing that is even remotely called treatment.
And the other thing is how much we've learned about the medications that can help with this. And, you know, Kevin, I'm a psychiatric nurse, and I've been in the field a long time, and I know about medications, and but I also know the pitfalls in using medications and the harm involved there. But when somebody is suffering so terribly through treatment and cravings and withdrawal, and if we can, you know, give that person some medication that will help them with that. And
Again, this is a really good example, Mike. This goes to our twisted attitudes. With any other disorder, we'd have no problems using medications, and we use medications for heart disease that routinely only work for 1 in 50. Why this intransigence about using any kind of medication to diminish the symptoms of especially protracted withdrawal that lasts over a year? Why aren't we doing anything that helps somebody to beat this disorder? You know, it's kind of crazy. We got emails after the film saying, oh, Mike needs to take the easy way out.
Easier, softer way. That's how it's termed. In
AA. And I think that, you know what, if the AA program works for you, that is great. But we don't feel that you need to suffer any more than the illness causes you to suffer already.
Mm-hmm. There's this kind of sense that if at all levels of the system, right, from just the general population and society right up to the policymakers and the politicians, that we need to bottom out, right, before we're going to get better. We need to hit rock bottom. And there's even, you know, treatment in the 80s and 90s that Synanon, which was AA-based and turned it, you know, evolved into a cult, basically. It was, you were humiliated and disparaged to such a degree and degraded to such a degree that you would literally bottom out because they would break you. And that's an extreme example of what I believe is a problem that permeates the whole system.
Filmmaker Maureen Palmer set out to make a documentary following her partner Mike Pond, a psychotherapist and an alcoholic 5 years sober, as he searched for the best new evidence-based addiction treatments. The intent was to help others battling substance use disorders. But to the couple's shock and dismay, shortly after filming began, Mike drank again. In their documentary, Wasted, Mike and Maureen's attitudes and assumptions about addiction are tested in real time as the couple search for a treatment that will work for Mike. Their theoretical journey became very real and deeply personal.
That description comes from the website of CBC's The Nature of Things. You can find Mike and Maureen's documentary film there. You can also find their book, Wasted, online at Amazon or in bookstores across North America. I spoke with Mike Pond and Maureen Palmer earlier this week. Here's the rest of that interview. Now, the documentary version of Wasted, and you mentioned it, it was aired on The Nature of Things. It was really impactful for me. I watched it, and as the news delivered during the documentary itself was that you had picked up alcohol again after a motorcycle accident, that completely surprised me. I don't know why it surprised me, but did it surprise you, Mike, that you drank again, or were you not surprised?
Surprise. I don't know if I'm trying to find a word, right, that would describe my feelings around that. And you know, I was 5.5 years without taking a drop of alcohol. And it wasn't just the motorcycle accident. There was a lot of predetermining kind of situations that had happened leading up to the accident and stuff about, you know, family and personal stuff that I don't want to disclose because, you know, I don't want my family to kind of be a part of all this stuff. I want to respect their privacy. And so it culminated in the accident. And then I ended up in the ER. And you got to know how I feel about emergency departments. I don't like them at all. And so after that whole thing and coming home after it all, yeah, just like in the film, I opened the fridge without even thinking about drinking and saw that bottle of wine sitting open there that, you know, there's always been a bottle of wine in our fridge. There has been for years. You know, Maureen will have a glass of wine once in a while or we entertain, and it was just there. And I grabbed it and I drank it. And, of course, immediate relief. This is the problem. Immediate relief from all of that angst and upset and disturbance, it is quite remarkable, you know, after that length of time not having a drink to experience again what those first 10 to 15 minutes felt like.
Well, I have to say that, first of all, Kevin, I was beyond shocked, right? I do say in the film that I was pretty smug. I never imagined a world where Mike would drink again.
Then
as we went out and filmed, and I saw Mike's experience in the fMRI, where they actually did what they call alcohol cue testing, you know, he felt nothing, cravings. I asked him as soon as he came out of it. He said he didn't feel any reaction to seeing those pictures of drinks. When we saw the picture of his brain lit up, clearly his brain felt differently. So, you know, I think there was, from the experience on the motorcycle to the ER to coming home, there was something going on in Mike's brain that was already priming him to find find and drink the first thing.
My brain knows what will give me instant relief.
Which made me think differently, of course, about having alcohol in the house.
Mm. You can still have alcohol in the house. If I want alcohol, I can get it. I can just walk out the back door here and one block down the street, I can get alcohol.
We got some horrible emails, Kevin, from people. I would say most of them within an AA or 12-step organization belief, accusing me of all manner of things by having that bottle of wine in the fridge, including
it was your fault. You'd actually
willingly wanting to sabotage his success. And what was my deeper need to do that? it really surprises me that people who don't know you can ascribe so many motivations to you because they saw a version of you, a tiny version of your life on TV. Now, I have to say, I don't feel comfortable right now with having alcohol in the house only because I have seen the fMRI. I don't, and I do hear Mike, if he really wants to drink, he'll go up to the corner and buy a cooler, but I just don't want to, I'm actually probably not having alcohol in the house very often for me, not for him. It's about my anxiety, not his.
And it, you know, I, one of my talks, well, pretty well every talk until I, you know, until the relapse, I would just say, because that's what we do, well, I'm 5 years sober, and, you know, resounding applause, right? Resounding applause. And now I can't say that, of course. But there's this belief that's the determiner, that's the number one determining factor of success in recovery from substance use disorders, is your term of sobriety. And I just don't believe that anymore.
And the experts actually agree with you, Mike. Like, I hearken back to the doc where Bill Miller says, you know, he did this study, a huge study of outcomes of treatment in America, where 25% are totally abstinent. The other 75% have a dramatic reduction in their drinking. That 75% is still considered a fail.
Mm-hmm.
Now, 25% complete remission and 75% dramatic reduction in symptoms in any other disorder, you know, the experts would be slapping themselves on the back, as would all the patients, right?
Glorious success.
Not an addiction, so that we hamstring ourselves by this mindset that is locked to the abstinence as the only method of gauging success.
A relapse is, you know, basically considered a fail. And I tell you, I felt like a failure. You know, every time a person that has this problem relapses, we feel like that. We feel like a complete failure. And in fact, the next morning, you know, I was woke up. I forgot what hangovers felt like, and it was horrible. And I was getting ready to go, to leave, because I felt that I had blown it, and everything was ruined, and, you know, and that's what happens. And guess what that does? When you feel like that then, and everybody else in your world is basically telling you that, then what's the next thing we're probably going to do? Drink some more, right? And this is the problem, one of the big problems with it. Is that attitude.
What can you tell us about your experiences with Vivitrol?
We had been researching naltrexone and all the other medications that are helpful with this problem. You know, that next day, Maureen had looked, you know, because you can't get Vivitrol in Canada. It's not approved yet, but...
It's a monthly injectable, just so people understand.
Yeah,
it's a drug that keeps cravings at bay for those for whom it works for up to 30 days.
Yeah, so it's naltrexone in a slow release form injectable, and which is great. And so she found a doctor in across the line in Bellingham, and we went down there, and I got the injection, and I felt the effects of that probably within half an hour to an hour as we were approaching the border coming back home. I told Maureen, I said, "This stuff's working. I can feel it."
Did say, I feel calmer, I feel less agitated, which is really considerable because, you know, what you can't see going on that day is we just started filming the documentary, and I, you know, Mike woke up, I told him we were going to Bellingham, but I also said, honey, I need to bring the camera crew, which, you know, oh, I've just relapsed, and now I'm going to have to live this relapse on national television. And I said, you know, we have to film it because we'll never be able to get this moment back. We don't know whether we'll ever use it. We don't even know now whether we're ever going to continue with this documentary. We just need to film it and then decide later what to do with it. So not only did he have to experience what he felt was the personal shame of having the relapse, but to have it recorded on camera. And that night, the night after, we, you know, pulled out the iPhones when we were in bed and talked about the experience, because I felt like I actually was wearing two hats here. One was the supportive partner, and I learned a lot about how to be a better partner in this issue, but also how will I capture this as a filmmaker? And those two, that duality was my nightmare for the next 8 or 9 months, because I knew the more we filmed, taking back Mike to Penticton and making him stand in front of his house, show us his office that he couldn't have anymore, show us the Greyhound, show us where he buried his booze on the beach. Writing the book was almost therapeutic, he said, because it was like narrative therapy. Filming for TV made the relapse much worse. And it made me feel very conflicted as a human being. And I would ask every once in a while, Mike, should we keep going? And he said he always wanted to keep going because he felt if we could come out the other side, we'd have something that would help a lot of other people. I think he's right.
Well, my whole life I've felt I never was a quitter. I don't believe in quitting. I believe that perseverance, is the secret to success. And you just keep pushing through and you just persevere. And as long as the attitude is about making things better and this will probably help a lot of people and help take away some, maybe it'll help take away some of the shame and some of the stigma. And that always kind of kept me, that was my guidepost to keep me going.
Mike Pond, Maureen Palmer, thank you very much for taking the time to speak with me.
Thank you, Kevin.
Thank you, Kevin. You're welcome.
Michael Pond has a private therapy practice in Vancouver, where he specializes in addiction treatment. Maureen Palmer is a critically acclaimed documentary filmmaker and former radio and television producer at CBC. You can find their book, Wasted, online at Amazon or in bookstores across North America. You can find the documentary of the same name at CBC's The Nature of Things website. And you can find out more about the ongoing work emerging from the book and the documentary online at addictionthenextstep.com.
People First Radio is an initiative of Vancouver Island Mental Health Society in partnership with Radio Malaspina Society and broadcast on CHLY 101.7, radio from Nanaimo, British Columbia. The opinions expressed are not necessarily those of the partnering organizations. Listen to People First Radio on demand. Just Google People First Radio to find our web pages.